But I trust the comfort break gave you a sufficient level of comfort, and you feel suitably refreshed. Just to point out, I know a couple of you, many of you, from FACE, and I think some people here are without a name badge. You might like your name badge after the drink reception afterwards, so people know people's names. So I think some of you have got a name badge to collect over there, which might be helpful, as I say, during the drink reception to collect. Just to add, any additional resources that didn't quite make it into the actual pack are available at the back table there, so copies of the Biochemist, the Biochemistry, Biochemical Society magazine, some literature on the Sheffield Law School and the PhD Foundation will all be found at the back there. Please do avail yourself of those resources. It's my pleasure to kind of chair the rest, the second half, the panel discussion later. So we'll move on with the second panel of speakers. There's a slight change, just simply just reordering things. We're now going to kick off with Alison Paul from the PhD Foundation, followed by Dr. Ruth Sturton, and finally Dr. Helen Wallace. Then we'll invite all six speakers up to the front, and we'll have a full panel of speaker discussion and dialogue between one another and also the audience. So could you please join me in welcoming to the podium Alison Paul. Thank you.
Came at very short notice, just with a day's notice, and what I'm going to talk about is the work that we do at the PhD Foundation, which some of you will be aware of. I'm a project manager there, and I have a background in law and nursing, and also a master's in ethics. But my focus today is really going to be on two projects that the Foundation's been working on. The PhD Foundation is a charity based in Cambridge, which has the mission or the aim of making science work for health and focusing particularly on the responsible use of biomedicine and genomics. And as our name suggests, our focus is both on population and public health, so we have the population focus and also on genomics. So I'm going to focus on two projects that we've been involved in. The first is on whole genome sequencing, and I've been looking at the ethical, legal, social implications of sequencing, and focusing particularly on managing incidental findings. So, incidental findings, there isn't actually a good definition in the literature, and it's used in various different ways. But I take it to mean findings that are outside the scope of the clinical inquiry. So what we're doing in our project is we're starting to think about how these technologies will be used in clinical care and within the NHS, so it's quite sort of UK focused. So whole genome technologies, what do they mean? Well, this slide just shows you the progression through from sort of light microscopy through to whole genome sequencing, which is where you identify every base along the genome. And there are around 3 billion loci or positions in the genome for a single strand, or 6 billion for a double strand. And of those, it's thought that around 3 to 4 million bases will differ from the reference genome. We're at a very early stage of knowledge. So at the moment, most of the research that's going on is either comparing a person's genome with a reference or comparing it with other family members. And of course, there are issues around privacy and confidentiality when you start looking at lots of different family members. So we envisage that these technologies will be used for multiple uses, so both targeted clinical use, but also looking a bit further ahead perhaps for public health screening, looking in asymptomatic high-risk groups. So it's likely that whole genome sequencing will yield unprecedented amounts of data, including incidental findings, and I'll look at that a little bit more just in a minute, and that there's going to be more systematic creation, retention, and sharing of genomic data and samples. And one of the drivers, of course, for using this technology is the exponential decrease in the cost. And this is data from NHGRI published in January, which shows you how much the cost has come down for sequencing. So I'm focusing on incidental findings because I think they are the things that where privacy and discrimination are likely to impact. And as I suggested, I think there are a variety of different sorts of incidental findings, both related to the actual clinical question that one might ask. So, for example, an incidental finding about new genetic variants, if you're looking at colon cancer, new genetic variants, which will inform why you have this particular colon cancer, or other health-related variants, like you're looking at your colon cancer, but you find a genetic variant that's associated with Alzheimer's disease or schizophrenia. And then there might be other variants that are social, or other incident findings that are social, so evidence of misattributed paternity or perhaps incest. And all these different incidental findings have a number of different dimensions to them. They may be serious, they may be irrelevant or sort of minor. They may be treatable or untreatable. They may have personal significance, such as ancestry information, for example. Or they may be individual. They may have different layers of relevance, and Brenda mentioned this, relevance to the individual, to the family or ethnic group. One of the interesting things about incidental findings in research is that people have only really begun to discuss it over the last few years. Until comparatively recently, researchers didn't disclose any incidental findings, even if there was a net benefit of doing so. But the discussions have changed so that people like Wolf started the discussion in the literature that actually there was an ethical imperative to disclose these things, particularly if there was a strong net benefit. And we've moved on now to other commentators such as Bergetel in a recent edition of Genetics in Medicine, which has identified five different categories of incidental findings. Ranging from the ones that bin one, that are medically actionable, through to other types of incidental findings that are either very significant or untreatable or less significant, through to this big group here, estimated to be around 20,000, which have unknown clinical implications. And of course, in the current state of knowledge that we have, a lot of the variants that are found using these technologies will have unknown clinical implications. And there are issues about the way, if we start in research context, for example, if we start telling research participants about these incidental findings, then there will be issues for their insurance, for their employment, and there are issues too in a clinical setting. I want to turn now to personalised medicine. I'm sorry, I'm zipping through really quickly. But we're also doing a project at the PhD Foundation looking at targeted approaches to screening. And this is part of a COBS project, an EU-funded project. I'm working with epidemiologists who are modelling using genetic variant information and screening. And I'm thinking through some of the ethical, legal, social issues involved. So we haven't had a definition of personalised medicine yet today, and I've just put one up here which clarifies that what I mean by personalised medicine is using information about an individual's genetic profile to discriminate between those who should receive a treatment or an intervention and those who shouldn't. So you can think about this in terms of diagnostics. Prognostics, for example, if you have a cancer that you want to test to see how it will respond to treatment and as an indicator of whether that cancer is likely to be very aggressive or not, or you can use it for therapeutics. So, however, what I'm going to discuss is stratifying patients for screening. Sorry, I've guessed ahead of myself. This is another project which I just think is relevant here, which is being run by Cancer Research UK, looking at individuals with common cancers and sequencing the genomes of those cancers to see how best, what treatment should be used and how to also obtain information about the prognosis of those cancers. Now, I'm going to talk about COBS and targeting screening. Because as I said, I work with a couple of epidemiologists, Paul Farrow and also Nora Pasharan, and What they have suggested is that instead of using an age-based screening strategy, which assumes that the average 50-year-old woman has a 2% chance, around 2% chance of getting breast cancer before the age of 60, you could use the same threshold. And knowing a person's genetic variance, you could then offer women with different genetic susceptibility screening at different times. So what this table shows is that for those who have low-risk variants, so 0.67 on the left-hand of the table, you actually delay their screening until a later age, whereas those who have more higher-risk variants, you might offer them screening at an earlier age, so you'd offer them at 40 rather than 50. And my colleague Nora has reclassified the population, of average hypothetical population of 100,000 women, to show what the efficacy of that approach would be. So this, within the red box, this shows the current age-based screening policy, where you screen around 65,000 women and you catch approximately 200 cancers. Bearing in mind that if you do screening, some of the people that you detect as positives will be false positives, and you'll miss some, you'll get false negatives too. Whereas if you reclassify those and you identify their genetic variants of these women, then you can target those who have higher genetic risks. And you end up screening less people, around 50,000, and you catch almost all the cancers that you would have otherwise done. So this is just a hypothetical model. So what sort of issues are raised by these sorts of models? Well, of course, there are issues around when you sample individuals, when you get those samples to test for genetic variants. So
Three
you
minutes.
Could have a situation like Brenda was talking about, where you systematically sample all your newborns and get your genetic variant information. But at a conference last week, we tended to think that that wouldn't be done because there'd be ethical objections, and also it would be too difficult to manage issues around long-term data storage, interrogation, data security would be really problematic. So our thought was that it's more likely that women in their mid-30s or early 40s would be targeted, but you would still have the difficulties of managing those at low and high risk. And also, insurers could use questions about being invited for screening as a proxy for actually whether they're at high risk. So you could say to a 42-year-old woman, have you attended for screening yet? Not a question about genetic variants, but a question about other things. There are issues around genetic exceptionalism and fatalism and medicalisation that's already come up. And of course, direct-to-consumer testing, because if low-risk individuals are denied screening through publicly funded screening, then of course they might use other routes to get information about genetic variants, which include information about children and vulnerable groups. And there are lots of issues around electronic consent and worries about that. So I'd like to just thank my colleagues at the PhD Foundation who've worked with me on this. Thank you.
Thank you.